Clinic helping children and youth with reading and writing problems on the web at readinggroup.org. Today's programming is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting Bat Boy, the musical, a pop rock musical that tells the story of a half boy, half bat, trying to find love and acceptance in a world that shuns him. Performances run from Wednesday, October 26th through Saturday, November 12th. More information is available at 351-2528.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the Middle East. And our guest for the program is Yossi Halevi. He's an Israeli author and journalist. He's contributing editor and Israel correspondent for The New Republic. He's been regular contributor on Israeli affairs for the Los Angeles Times and occasional contributor to the New York Times and the Washington Post. He's the author of the book At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. That came out in 2001. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Shalom Center. He has been active in Mideast reconciliation efforts. He's worked as a senior writer for the biweekly magazine Jerusalem Report from its founding in 1990 until 2002. And he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be spending almost 2 weeks here giving a number of talks. Let me mention just two of them, of the many. He'll be talking on the subject, Opportunities for Peace Between Israel and the Palestinians After Gaza. And this will be taking place on the 27th, which is, I believe, Thursday?
I think so.
Is that right? I should check my calendar. Yes, on Thursday, I believe.
And I'm a little jet-lagged.
At the Beckman Institute at 7:30 in the evening. This is the 27th. That is Thursday. And then also, let me just mention one other because it's an issue that comes up frequently and people might be interested. He'll be giving a talk sponsored by Journalism on November 2nd, speaking at a brown bag in room 336 of Gregory Hall, looking at media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I'm guessing that anybody who would want to attend should feel welcome to stop by. Questions here on this program are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Probably in Israel and Israeli politics, the biggest thing by far that has happened in the recent past was the withdrawal from Gaza. And I'm interested in hearing you talk about that. And what it, how it came about, and what it meant. Perhaps to talk a little bit first about why it happened at all. This something that was proposed by the Prime Minister, Mr. Sharon. He faced a great deal of opposition. Many Israelis were opposed to it. Many people within his own political party were opposed to it. Why did he decide to do this?
Well, to answer that, I think we need to step back a little bit and get some perspective on the development of Israeli political thinking over the last, I'd say, two decades, beginning with the First Intifada in the late 1980s. And the effect of the First Intifada on the Israeli mainstream was to convince a majority of Israelis that the Israeli left had been right all along when it warned against the dangers of occupation. And the public emerged out of that First Intifada convinced that what we need to do is find a partner on the other side and proceed toward dismantling the occupation. And that was the First Intifada was the conceptual victory of the left. The Second Intifada has in some sense been the victory of the right, which warned all along that you can't make a deal with Yasser Arafat, with the PLO, because they really will not accept the legitimacy, the existence of a Jewish state in any borders. So that when Arafat walked away from Camp David in July 2000, when Israel offered 91-92% of the territories plus East Jerusalem as a capital, and not only said no, but said no with a 5-year war of suicide bombings, the Israeli mainstream that had previously rejected occupation had now come to the conclusion that the Oslo process had been a mistake. Now, what happened to the Israeli public was very interesting. Rather than the majority shift back to the right, the consensus was both the left and the right had failed. And the operative conclusion of that is that if you can't occupy the Palestinians, which Israelis came to realize in the first Intifada, and you can't make peace with Arafat and this generation of Palestinian leaders, which was the conclusion from the second Intifada, then the only alternative is to unilaterally withdraw, not wait for a partner to emerge on the other side, and to determine your own borders. That is how unilateral withdrawal happened.
Hmm. What does this mean, or did this mean something for the way that Israelis, or a lot of Israelis, think about themselves and their country? And in the sense that, it, at the very least, it was saying that this idea of a greater Israel is not to be, and that if Israel is going to maintain its character, being primarily a Jewish state, that it's going to have to be smaller rather than larger.
Yeah, I think that we ended up surprising ourselves at how smoothly the withdrawal went. A majority of Israelis were supportive of this withdrawal from the very beginning. It made no sense to most of us to continue maintaining isolated settlements deep in Palestinian population areas. And it was clear to the settlers that they were isolated and they were going to lose. So yes, this was a shock in terms of dragging fellow citizens out of their homes. There was a trauma involved. But in terms of the shock of the end of Greater Israel, what I was trying to say earlier is that most of us went through that trauma in the first Intifada 15 or so years ago, so that the Israeli left won that argument in the late 80s. Hmm. And what we're seeing now is really the belated operative conclusion to that conceptual breakthrough.
So what happens now with the West Bank?
For now, the Israeli public wants to see what's going to happen in Gaza. If Gaza can emerge with all of its problems as a relatively stable society, if Abbas, the chairman of the PA, manages to not just impose a ceasefire, but also to disarm Hamas and his own Fatah gangs, then I think the Israeli public, regardless of what Sharon may intend, will demand that we proceed to negotiate serious negotiations over the West Bank. If Gaza implodes, which is more likely than not at this point, then I think the Israeli public will be very divided about what to do next.
Is that Mahmoud Abbas, obviously, as you say, is facing a lot of problems because he has a lot of opposition. There are a lot of militants under his umbrella who don't particularly support his leadership. There are still within the Palestinian movement, there are militants who won't accept the idea of the existence of Israel, who are continue to be willing to use violence. And one wonders whether he has many tools to deal with those kind of people. Is there anything that Israel could do to help? And is it likely that Israel would, if it could?
You know, that's the standard journalistic question. What should Israel be doing next to help the emergence or the strengthening of moderate Palestinian leadership? No one expected Israel to unilaterally withdraw. If you go back 3-4 years, pull out thousands of settlers and destroy 21 settlements. Israel has withdrawn now to the 67 borders in Gaza, created the conditions for the beginnings of Palestinian statehood. I would say a test case for whether Palestine can be a peaceful neighbor to Israel. And the attitude among average Israelis who are neither left-wing nor right-wing is we've just handed Abbas a major opportunity. including control over the border crossings, which initially Israel, for security reasons, was very concerned about yielding. And now we're waiting to see whether Abbas is going to take the most minimal steps that he's required to do under the roadmap. If you look at the roadmap, before the roadmap even begins, the Palestinians need to disarm the terrorist groups. Abbas is not doing that. So that Sharon has gone several steps forward down the line on the roadmap by dismantling settlements, which is supposed to be at the very end of the process, while Abbas has not yet begun the most minimal requirements on the Palestinian side. So if you're asking your average Israeli what should Israel do next, the answer would be wait and see what happens.
Mm. So you're saying that most Israelis would say we've done what we're going to do.
For now.
And we're now going to see what happens on the other side.
We've done what we're going to do as a first stage to try to jumpstart the process. Now we need to see, I would say, three things. One is disarm the terrorists, and it's not only Hamas, it's also Fatah. The second is begin resettling refugees living in Gaza, now under a sovereign Palestinian regime, so that Palestine needs to stop being the only territory in the world that keeps its own people in refugee camps. And the third, maybe for me, the most important point is for the systematic delegitimization of Jewish history, of the right of the Jewish people to any part of the land of Israel slash Palestine, that needs to stop in the Palestinian media, the official media controlled by Abbas. And there's been almost no change in that message of delegitimization in the transition from Arafat to Abbas.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Yossi Klein Halevi, he's a contributing editor, Israeli correspondent of The New Republic, has contributed to many other magazines. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Shalom Center, is in Jerusalem.
Yes.
He grew up here in the United States. He was born and raised in New York and moved to Israel in 1982 and makes his home there in Jerusalem. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give a number of talks over the next week or a little more. Now, questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here to talk with. So if you will put on the headphones, we will go to the phones. Starting with someone in Urbana, and this is line number, line four. The caller is in Indiana. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Two questions. One, to sort of, I don't know, you know if there's a good answer to it, but in terms of the model, the IRA, and you mentioned the word gangs a couple of times, and a lot of people have talked about the IRA when it was in its epitome, that basically they were just gangs, similar to the gangs we had in the West going around robbing banks and things like terrorizing citizens and stuff. I was wondering if that such a phenomenon happens with the Hamas and those groups, or are they, you know, since where are they on the spectrum from 0 to 100% political endeavors versus just, you know, some young kids say, this is a good way to get some money. I don't really care too much about the politics of it, but I sure like to carry a gun and scare the hell out of people. And the second question deals with what will be the next step if the presumed demands that the Jewish state would like to see happen in Palestine if the reciprocity doesn't take place. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Both very good questions. When I used the word gangs, I didn't refer to Hamas, even though Hamas is a terrorist group. It's not a gang. It's a very well-organized movement with clear political goals. The term gang actually applies more ironically toward groups that supposedly maintain loyalty to Mahmoud Abbas. The Fatah gangs are more loosely organized. Many of them are in the protection racket and are no less a threat to Abbas's ability to control Palestinian society and maintain a functioning state than Hamas. So Abbas is really facing two problems. One is what to do with a rival political movement that is well-armed with very clear political goals. And the second, within his own backyard, is what to do with his own Fatah gangs, who are not in anyone's control. In terms of what are the options facing Israel if Abbas proves either unable or unwilling to control the terrorist threats in Gaza, my own feeling, I would say my own hope, is that Israel will then proceed to the next stage of unilateralism, which is to determine what are the minimal security borders we need in the absence of peace as a short-term or middle-term response, and then withdraw to those borders, pull up as many settlements as we need to give the Palestinians territorial contiguity on most but not all of the West Bank, and then wait and see what happens next. My sense is that that is where Sharon himself is going to go if there is no Palestinian reciprocity.
All right. To the next caller here, that would be line number one, Champaign County. Hello.
Good morning. Since you're talking in quite broad strokes, I thought I guess I will mention this. You're talking about gangs. There's an interesting dimension of Israeli history that the antecedents of Likud and Sharon's is the Stern Gang and the Argun, and this latest opening to Berlusconi and his types by the Likud, the government of Israel, is sort of reminds me of Jabotinsky and the revisionists and all of that history. One thinks of Israel, one thinks of the people coming from Europe, but the antecedents of Likud were actually the people that were already on the ground and they were fighting the British. But you mentioned that you're saying that this is a unilateral move, and I think you're missing a dimension, and we're sitting in the middle of part of that dimension. It's actually bilateral. The Bush administration insisted on something to happen. It has to show something besides bombing Iraq as far as democratizing the Middle East, and I think that the stipulations were made from the Bush administration that Sharon had to find some sort of gesture to do to make it put up some kind of appearance. You know, we know that the Gaza is actually still surrounded and actually hasn't been, it's been depopulated of settlers, but it hasn't been unoccupied in the sense that the boundaries are actually quite restricted and there's no commerce allowed. So it's a prison with the guards now on the outside, and it's designed to fail, and it's going to be manipulated to fail because then Sharon and probably a lot of the Americans can also say, well, they can't handle their freedom when they have the freedom of a prison. The Elliot Abrams letter that stipulated that if Gaza would go ahead, then we would wink at the building of settlements. This is part of the roadmap that apologists for the Israeli state as it currently exists in this militarized situation, which is good for no one of the inhabitants, never really bring up that part of the roadmap. So that's quite a lot to deal with, and I appreciate it. I guess I'll hang around if there's no one else waiting.
No, I do have a couple of other callers. Maybe let's give the guest a chance to make some comment and then see where we are.
Well, let me address the question of Gaza as a prison. The question of border crossings, for a long time, when Sharon first raised the possibility of unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, the Israeli security establishment was most concerned about ceding control over the border crossing with Egypt. The fear was that that crossing would become permeable, and rather than Qassam rockets, which is what Hamas is now has been shooting at Israel, their range will become greater with Katyushas that could be smuggled in, for example, from Lebanon. In the end, Israel decided to cede the border crossing with Egypt and take that security risk precisely because it did not want to hermetically seal Gaza and leave Gaza open to the Arab world. In terms of the connection to the West Bank, which of course runs through Israeli territory, Israel is sandwiched between the West Bank and Gaza, that depends on what happens with terrorism. And here one cannot absolve the Palestinian leadership of responsibility. Israel will not allow a free flow between the West Bank and Gaza until there's some indication that Abbas is serious about controlling terror. The Israeli public wants to see Gaza work. The Israeli public as a whole, and I'm talking about 60 to 70% of the Israeli public, wants more than anything for this occupation to end and for some sort of normalcy to come to the Middle East. That's in my interest as an Israeli more than it's in your interest, for example, as a concerned outsider. And I want Gaza to work, but I want it to work in a way that will not endanger my my family's security, for example. And that really depends on controlling terror. So here we're going to need to see some beginnings of a Palestinian recognition that there's an opportunity that exists that didn't happen before. Yes, it's a limited opportunity, but even limited opportunities don't come along very often in the Middle East.
If caller, if you wanted to follow up,
a lot of people wanted to succeed, but I don't think that includes the leaders of Likud particularly. I think they would be perfectly happy to see it be a failed state and keep quarantining it, because then it would allow no negotiations to have to go ahead, and the U.S. would keep backing Israel, even though it's clearly building settlements where, you know, Bush every now and then, Condi goes there and says these settlements, the wall is even not something that they approve of, but they keep paying for it. So it's, you know, there's a lot to sort out here. I hope for the best, but I'm afraid I'm rather pessimistic because I don't see that there's a good faith going ahead on a lot of different levels, not just the Palestinians. Their bad faith is notoriously championed but the U.S. is not an honest broker in this and never has been. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Could I respond to this one point?
Yes, sir.
In terms of the U.S. not being an honest broker, the Clinton administration got Israel to the point where, after the failure of Camp David in December 2000, President Clinton came up with what became known as the Clinton proposals. 97% of the West Bank, 100% of Gaza. Three out of the four quarters of the old city of Jerusalem would be handed to the Palestinians. Israel said yes, and the Palestinians said no. So that the closest the Palestinians have come to genuine statehood with territorial contiguity was under the auspices of the United States. So I'd be careful here about the anti-American rhetoric. The second point about building settlements, the settlement building as a project is basically over. Now, I say the word basically because there are several settlements in the area around Jerusalem, which are no longer settlements but towns, really cities, that are very close to the border and which everyone knows Israel will continue to control no matter what happens in terms of peace agreement. The most likely scenario is that 2 or 3% of the West Bank in the event of a peace agreement will be ceded to Israel, and Israel will then in exchange cede territory from within pre-1967 Israel to a Palestinian state, which is in fact what the Clinton proposals stipulated. So that even in the most far-reaching peace proposals, Israel will continue to maintain its presence in 2 or 3% of the West Bank, which is precisely where these towns are. And that is where the building is happening. There is no unlimited settlement building going on in 97% of the West Bank. That's over.
Just real quick, if you could, I am curious, and I would like to have you talk just a little bit about what's going on these days within Likud. The former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is challenging Ariel Sharon for leadership, and I think a fundamental issue that they're struggling over, at least I think Mr. Netanyahu is basing his opposition on Ariel Sharon's withdrawal from Gaza,
right?
And that it seems to be something that's to some extent is roiling the party, if not tearing it apart. Is this something that has some serious implications for the future of Likud as a political party in Israel?
Well, it does. The Likud is on the verge of a split. I think it has more profound implications for the future of the Israeli political system. We're in an anomalous situation today because the Israeli majority has moved to the point where it no longer accepts the possibility of greater Israel on the one hand, and is very skeptical of reaching a peace agreement with this generation of Palestinian leaders on the other. So that unilateralism is really tailor-made for this Israeli majority. The only political figure of substance in Israel today who represents that majority consensus is Sharon. There is no political party that represents the unilateralist perspective. And after Sharon, I mean, the man is 78. He has somewhat of a weight problem. I don't know who is going to follow him and be able to continue to represent that centrist, moderate Israeli majority.
Just then, let me pick up on one more thing you said, the comment about the hesitance of many Israelis to believe that it's possible to reach an agreement, some kind of relationship with this generation of the Palestinian leadership. Are you talking about Mahmoud Abbas, his generation?
Yes.
Then do you think that there then is a younger group, people who would be in a position to be the next generation of leadership, where there would be any greater possibility of having working the relationship out?
I do. I think that the tragedy of the Oslo process was that we imposed, we meaning Israel, by initiating the Oslo process, we imposed the leadership of the PLO that came from Tunis onto the population of the West Bank and Gaza. For all of the difficulty in Israeli-Palestinian relations over the years and all of the tragedy of the occupation, nevertheless, the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza lived with us. And we had relationships. They knew Israeli society intimately. And my sense is that the younger generation of that local leadership is more suited to deal with the Israeli mentality and to find a way of Palestinians and Israelis coexisting than the leadership that came in from Tunis that was really parachuted in. And in effect imposed on the local population.
We'll take a couple of other calls in just a moment. I'd like to just take long enough to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. Yossi Halevi is a contributing editor and Israel correspondent for The New Republic. He has been a regular contributor on Israeli affairs to other publications, including Los Angeles Times, and an occasional contributor to The New York Times and The Washington Post. He worked as a senior writer for the biweekly magazine The Jerusalem Report from 1990 until 2002. He is the author of the book At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land, published in 2001. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be here for a couple of weeks and giving a number of different talks and public presentations. One I do want to mention again because it gets at the subject we're talking about here this morning is opportunities for peace between Israel and the Palestinians after Gaza. This takes place at the Beckman Institute on the U of I campus. It's at 405 North Matthews. This is Thursday, October 27th, Thursday at 7:30 in the evening. Questions welcome here on the program. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The lines are full, so folks will help us if they can try and be brief in their comments. Next up is Champagne, line 2.
Yeah, I have to agree with the previous caller that the policies of the Sharon government seem calculated to make the peace process fail. On the one hand, while they stage a strategic withdrawal, they're also building, even though the guests did say that they're building in areas that are already under Israeli control. It also stands, you know, most of the natural resources like water may also be in these places where Israelis are building these new settlements. So just swapping 2 to 3% of West Bank in one area for some other area in Israel may not really work in the Palestinians' favor in the long term. Number two, while the Sharon government continues to say it is interested in the peace plan, you know, it is contravening not just the peace plan by building new settlements, but also by going against several Security Council resolutions or UN resolutions or whatever it is they're called, prohibiting such build-out. So I think the real tragedy here seems to be that the Palestinians have really no good leadership to make a good case to the world that they can actually be a responsible party in these negotiations, but also that the Sharon government, backed by the Bush administration with its neocons, really have a very vested interest in having the whole thing fail. I'll just hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
All right. All right.
Thank you for the comment. Again, the question of settlements. Let's take it back a step. When there was an attempt by the international community to solve the Middle East conflict at Camp David in 2000, with the Clinton proposals in December 2000, then at Taba in Egypt 2 months later, Israel put on the table an offer to dismantle most of the settlements and to return to what would be, in effect, the 1967 borders with very minor adjustments, and again giving compensatory territory within Israel proper to a Palestinian state for whatever Israel would retain. Now, that for the Israeli public today is the starting point of discussing the future of the Middle East. We made the offer that the international community insisted we make for 35 years. We finally did it. We became the first country in history to offer to voluntarily share sovereignty over its capital city. What we got back was 5 years of suicide bombings. You can't begin a discussion of the future of the Middle East without taking into consideration the trauma that the Israeli public has reached. Now, I don't minimize the trauma that the Palestinians have suffered through occupation over the last three decades. But something changed in the year 2000. And the fact that the Palestinian leadership, and I stress leadership rather than people, violently rejected an offer that would have decisively ended the occupation and given the Palestinians control over a contiguous Palestinian state can't simply be wiped out of the discussion. And to talk about the fact that Israel is building 200 or 300 apartment units in a town 2 miles away from Jerusalem, which everyone, including Palestinian negotiators, know is going to remain under Israeli control no matter what agreement is reached, that really strikes me as a kind of a time warp. The problem is no longer settlements, and Israel proved it. And if there is an Israeli government that's going to try to annex the territories, if there's a credible Palestinian leadership that's offering us real peace, recognition, legitimacy, acceptance of a Jewish state, then the Israeli public will simply throw that leader out.
Let me, for a moment, ask you to talk a little bit more about that. You made a couple times reference to the offer that Israel made to the Palestinians at the time when Yasser Arafat was still alive and leading the Palestinians. And this is something that I know people disagree on and have been for a long time. That is, the people who take the perspective of the Palestinians say that Israel is being somewhat disingenuous where they talk about what a great offer this was, because if you take a look at it, particularly look at the territory that was being offered, that it was not a viable state, and that Arafat, from his perspective, looked at that and said, "If I agree to this, then I never will have the possibility. I'll be locked into this, and never will have the possibility for a viable state." And it's not that, on the one hand, as you represent and other people represent it, they say this was the best offer that's ever been made, and Arafat said it was almost everything he'd ever asked for, and he turned away. On the other side, people say, well, you know, maybe it wasn't, the offer wasn't that good. And as I say, people have been arguing about what it was or what it wasn't. Why do you think, if that offer was so good, why do you think that Arafat said no?
The argument focuses on what happened and what didn't happen at Camp David. It ignores what happened 3 months later or 4 months later with the Clinton proposals. Mm-hmm. Clinton decisively cleared up the argument in December 2000 when he put what he thought should be the offer on the table. And that offer was 96 or 97% of the West Bank, 100% of Gaza, 3% or 2% of territory within Israel proper being offered to a Palestinian state, and control of most of the old city of Jerusalem. That offer, there is never going to be a better offer than that. And Israel said yes to that. So I'm not interested in arguing about what happened at Camp David or didn't happen. 4 months later, Clinton put the decisive offer on the table. Why did Arafat say no? There's all kinds of speculation. Some say that the thought of becoming a leader of a small and insignificant Arab state, number 23, was much less enticing than continuing the revolution. That Arafat was built for revolution and went to his death as a revolutionary fighter. That's a psychological argument. I think there are more serious political arguments, which is that Israel refused, and the Clinton proposals accepted Israel's refusal, to consider accepting Palestinian refugees into the Jewish state. Palestinian refugees would have to go to a Palestinian state. And that, for Israel, is the bottom line prerequisite for an agreement. We will not accept the destruction demographically of a Jewish state through refugee return. There will be, hopefully, refugee return to a Palestinian state. And I think that's the real reason Arafat rejected it. And what makes me pessimistic about Abbas is that he supported Arafat's rejection because of the issue of refugee return.
Let's talk again with another caller. The next, Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Really happy to be able to speak to someone from the other side, because usually the discussions we have here are with people who agree with our position. I've spoken with people that are concerned with this issue, from Americans to Palestinians to Israelis who come out on the left side. I believe the gentleman, however, would be one of the first times I've had an experience to speak to someone that could answer the following question. Before I begin, I believe that there can be credible arguments drawn that each people, the Palestinians and the Israeli, are both victimized people. They have so much in common, they almost, like, need each other. The fact is, we are more, as Americans, sir, concerned outsiders is a very inadequate term to refer to us. We are paying for everything over there. We're paying with billions of dollars while we can't even keep our own people in New Orleans above water. The fact is, if you put three items on the table, if you put the Arabs and the Jews on the table, and you put three items on the table, democracy, Jewish state, and rule all the land. These are the three concepts. And if you go to Panera Bread Company, you know, they have this lunch that says, you take two. If you want all three, it'll never work. You have to get two of the three. So if we could offer to the Israelis, take two of these, Jewish state, democracy, or rule all the land. If you take Jewish state and rule all the land, then you can no longer call it a democracy. If you say Jewish state and democracy, then that means that's a two-state solution with two states living side by side with that's what most of the world wants. My point is this. If you can take these three concepts, Jewish state, democracy, rule all the land, and if you just take two of them and leave the other one, that'll solve the whole problem. I'll listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I appreciate the comment. It's very well put. I think you're pushing through an open door, because what I've been trying to convey in this discussion is that there now exists, and there really has existed since the first intifada of the late 80s, a solid Israeli majority that has in fact opted for two out of the three, as you put it, for a democratic Jewish state, and has repudiated the dream of Greater Israel. The dream of Greater Israel ended for the Israeli public with the election of Yitzhak Rabin in 1992. Rabin was the first Israeli leader to say clearly there is no possibility of Greater Israel. Now, Ariel Sharon, of all people, this was a totally unexpected turn of events. Ariel Sharon recently spoke at the UN, and he said not only that there will be a Palestinian state, but more significantly, he said the Palestinians deserve a state. When I hear Abbas, or for that matter, any Palestinian leader, say that the Jewish people deserves a state in any part of the land, that is what's going to solve the problem. Because that will then convince the Israeli majority that's ready, that's desperate for this two-state solution and is ready to pay the territorial price. That will convince the Israeli majority that it is safe to withdraw, that we can then trust a Palestinian leadership to bring their people along to accept my legitimacy, the fact that I also have a right to part of this land. So that the question is not a Palestinian state anymore. The question is an Israeli state. Will the Arab world, and especially the Palestinians, accept the legitimacy of a Jewish state in any borders? And as far as we're concerned in Israel, that question has not yet been answered.
And I'm sure that on the Palestinian side, the Palestinians would say, no, we did this. We said that we accepted the existence of Israel, that we have given up the idea that we could drive the Israelis into the sea and take this land back by force of arms. What is it you expect us to do that we have not done already?
What I expect is not only for Saeb Erekat and other Palestinian spokespeople to say we accept Israel when they speak when they speak on CNN in English, but to say the same thing in Arabic to their own people. I follow the Palestinian media, and what I see there is systematic delegitimization of the Jewish right to any part of this land. There never was an ancient Jewish presence in the land of Israel, according to mainstream Palestinian media. There never was a temple in Jerusalem. There was no Holocaust. That's a Zionist invention. And that you'll see routinely in the Palestinian media, including in Abbas's media. It's not just in Hamas newspapers. That, for me, is the test case of whether we can move forward. When I start seeing at least a debate in the Palestinian media, did the Holocaust happen or not, then I'll be able to feel that, okay, there's some new thinking going on within official Palestinian circles that we haven't seen before.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Yossi Halevi. He's contributing editor, Israel correspondent of The New Republic. He's also an author, has written for various publications. He's here visiting the campus. We'll continue and talk next with a listener in Charleston on line 4. Hello.
Yes. My question is, how is it possible, given the history of Israel, I mean, like 5,000 years ago, their nomadic existence then, their starvation in Egypt, their return, and all this under the hand of a so-called God that says, go and take the land from the Hittites and the Amalekites and these other peoples who are evidently already in Palestine, then it lapses after, I think it was Trajan who removed the Israelites from Palestine, the diaspora, I think it's called. And then in the 20th century, you have Western powers, namely the U.S. and England, who imposed back in Palestine, to the horror of the Palestinians, these people are going to be here, and you people are going to be history. And therein lies the problem. You cannot impose, unless you do it American style, like we did to the Native Americans here, who the state of things was to exterminate the North American Indians, get them out of the way and off the land, and we will have then our hegemony in this country. And you repeat that same sort of madness in the Middle East to this day. What is it now? Since 1948, that there has been no resolution to any of this, and there shall not be until the Israelites are given a land of their own. My question always has been, why didn't the U.S. and England, who engineered all this stuff, then give the Israel a state in the United States, and then this will be Israel. But no, they're not going to practice what they preach. So that's my question. How do you think this is ever going to be resolved? In my estimate, it's not.
All right. Well, comment?
Well, heavy heart, as I hear our last caller, because it's precisely that sense of distortion of history or selective reading of history whose aim is to deny any historical legitimacy to a Jewish state in the land of Israel-Palestine that is making this conflict go on and on. When the United States and Britain, as you put it, and really the international community, voted for a Jewish state at the UN in 1947, the UN also voted for the creation of a Palestinian state. Two states were supposed to emerge in 1947. All the land was not just given, as you put it, to the Israelites or the Jewish people, as I would prefer to put it, but the land was supposed to be shared. The Arab world categorically rejected a Jewish state in any borders. In the 1937 Peel Commission report, which was by the British mandate, offered the Palestinians 80% of the land and the Jews 20%, and that was too much for the Arab world. In terms of the notion of an invasion 5,000 years ago, no country that I can think of 5,000 or 4,000 or 1,000 years ago didn't experience invasions. The Palestinians in the land today, many of them came through the Muslim invasion of the 7th century. So let's not play this game of history. If we're really looking to solve the conflict, then the starting point needs to be there's a Palestinian people, there's an Israeli people. We both have legitimacy as nations because we see ourselves as nations. And the only way to solve this is by accepting the legitimacy of a two-state solution.
Let's go to Champaign for another call. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned the Clinton administration's proposal offering the PLO 90% of the West Bank and all of Gaza. Concerning the proposal, did it allow for complete autonomy of those territories, such as infrastructure? And would it have allowed the Palestinians to have a viable military, open up the airports, build a constructive commerce? And if it didn't, why would it be necessary for Arafat to accept those conditions when it would only be nominally possessing Palestine, when in fact it would be Israel who would actually control the infrastructure of the Palestinian territories? Thank you.
Under the Clinton proposals, the territory would not be 90%, but 97% of the West Bank, 100% of Gaza, including airports, including infrastructure, resources, water. The one limitation would have been on Palestinian military power. The state would have been demilitarized with, of course, a strong police force and some form of symbolic army. But Israel, at least initially, would have required nothing less than that as some sort of guarantee that it wasn't creating a Trojan horse that would then continue the war against Israel from the 1967 borders. Why are all the questions hostile to Israel? This is really extraordinary.
Another caller here, Arcola. It's line number two. Hello.
Yes, I just have a quick question, one of the Jewish faith structural questions. What are the Pharisees called today or the Sadducees called today? Because I don't hear those names used in any of the news reports, or I assume those are still viable structures within the faith.
No, they're not actually. They stopped existing as categories 2,000 years ago.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop, I think, because we have come to the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, Yossi Halevi, will be giving a talk on the subject opportunities for peace between Israel and the Palestinians after Gaza. This is at the Beckman Institute, Thursday night at 7:30, 405 North Matthews on the U of I campus. Anyone interested in attending can do that. Our guest, Yossi Halevi, is the Israel correspondent, contributing editor of the New Republic. You might also look at his book, At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land, published in 2001. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much.
The broadcast today made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination from new to antique to complement anti-decor, Eastern Rugs, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, restaurant serving foods from Northern Italy, The Great Impasta at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, and Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you, David. Coming up at noon, we will join National Public Radio for an announcement from President Bush. The president is expected to announce who he would like to see succeed Alan Greenspan as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Greenspan is due to step down from the post at the end of January. That coming up at noon. In the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today, award-winning science journalist and author Dava Sobel will be our guest. She's the author of the bestsellers Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. We'll talk with her about her latest book, which is about the planets of our solar system. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices are lower. December wheat trading at 323, that down 7. March, 337 and 3 quarters, down 7 and a quarter. December corn, 199 and a quarter, down 2 and a quarter. March, 212 and a half, down 2. May corn, 220 and 3 quarters, down 2. December, 245 and a half, down 1 and a quarter. November soybeans, 568 and 3 quarters, down 3 and a half. January, 580 and 3 quarters, down 3 and 3 quarters. March, 589 and a half, down 2 and a half. December soybean meal, 169.20, that down 20. December oil, 23.21, down 27. October feeder cattle, 115.65, that down 30. October live cattle, 88.10, down 47 and a half. December lean hog, 60.35, down 42 and a half. February bellies, 87.45, that down 75. December crude, 59.80, down 83. The CRB, 320.20, down 231. The U.S. dollar, 89.94, that down 32. The Dow up 113 points at 10,329. The NASDAQ up 14 at 1193. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in southern and eastern Indiana, cloudy with scattered areas of light rain and occasional drizzle. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with scattered areas of drizzle, mainly south.